right, everybody, welcome back to this month's Real Geeks. We'll be discussing Ant-Man and the Wasp, and for those of you who caught last month's review, more importantly, I found Trevor!
I'm alive!
Turns out we kind of accidentally left him in the quantum realm a little too long. My bad.
Yeah.
Oops.
It hurt to breathe after a while.
Yeah, I could see that. Sorry.
I'm here, that's the main thing.
Exactly. So, Ant-Man and the Wasp. This is basically Marvel filling in a few of the blanks before Infinity War.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a good palate cleanser after Infinity War in terms of release because, you know, this is 2 months later. We are all still kind of reeling after Infinity War. And, it's nice to actually just kind of take a moment, just a little breather, and actually laugh.
Exactly.
Because, there was humor in Infinity War. There's humor in every Marvel movie. But both Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp actively try to be just straight-up comedy. So, this one basically picks up shortly after the events of Civil War, similar to how Spider-Man Homecoming did and similar to how Black Panther did. And this time, though, we're, of course, following Scott. And this is, I think, several months later.
It's a little... I would assume 2 years after Civil War.
Yeah, I couldn't remember exactly. I know there was a certain amount of time he's been under house arrest, and the movie takes place like shortly before his house arrest is about to be up.
Yeah, they do say 2 years, and if I remember right, it's 3 days before he's finally getting the ankle bracelet off.
Yes, that's right. So we're picking up with him in this regard. And he's just trying to get on with his life, right? He's spending time with Cassie.
Yep.
He's getting a business together, a security firm with his old con buddies called X-Con Security, which I love the pun. It's fantastic.
It's stylish and it really does work.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Hank and Hope have been on the run because the events that happened in that German airport basically outed them because it was their suit, right? So now we're in a scenario of them, because they're technically against the Sokovia Accords or whatever, that they're now on the run from the FBI.
Yeah, they're basically... Scott's been arrested. They're his accomplices, so they're essentially just as guilty as Scott is.
Yeah.
Which I think legally doesn't quite work, but as with, let's be honest, most of the science in these movies, yeah, sure.
Yeah. And we learn that they've been trying to develop a quantum tunnel based on some old blueprints of Hank's from back in the day. And use that to go into the quantum realm and actually find Janet Van Dyne. Because based on what happened with Scott in the first movie of going into the quantum realm and managing to come back, Hank thinks that there's a chance that she's still alive.
And also, since I've just made fun of the science of this movie, I do also have to give them credit because quantum tunneling is a real scientific thing.
Mm-hmm. In terms of like all the like the quantum physics stuff that they seem to be dealing with here, I mean, I'm no scientist, but the general impression that I'm getting watching these movies is that they do a lot of research before making these movies into actually getting the science of quantum physics as correct as they can get it, while still being within the context of this being a science fiction movie and thus playing around a little bit with scientific theory.
There is that point where you do have to go, it's a Marvel movie, who cares?
Mm-hmm. And, so Scott ends up having this weird dream where he seems to almost be embodied within Janet from a moment of her past.
Yep.
And then he calls Hank out of the blue on a burner phone and tells him. And then, lo and behold, he's absconded by Hope, and events go off from there because they that seems to reassure them that she's still alive, and they have to finish assembling the tunnel and everything, so they're going on this thing to get this one part that they need from this arms dealer guy or whatever, and played by Walton Goggins. And you know, here's now the third movie this year where Walton Goggins has effectively been a kind of whatever character. And it's like, why are we wasting his talents on this?
I was thinking about this on the way up here, and I truly think what happened is this. That character is not super necessary to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly think somebody went, oh, we can get Walton Goggins. Write in a part for him. And I'm sorry, if I'm a movie producer and you tell me I can get Walton Goggins,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I'm telling you to write in a part for the man.
Mm-hmm.
And especially now with the success where you have more and more people going, I would love to do a Marvel movie. And again, it's like, oh, we can get you? All right, come on down. We'll figure something out for you. We'll get you in there somewhere.
I also love the fact that they managed to get Lawrence Fishburne in this movie.
And
he plays an old friend, well, I shouldn't say old friend, an old colleague of Hank Pym's from back in the day, named, I want to say Ben Foster? I know it's Bill Foster, who, of course, worked on a project back in the day called Goliath, which is in reference to the comics that particular character held the mantle of the superhero character Goliath, who was basically Black Giant Man.
Yeah, he was very much a Hank Pym knockoff.
Yeah, and so, you know, of course, just as I'm sure you saw in the trailer, there was that whole moment between the two of them of like, oh, the biggest I got was like 25 feet. What was the biggest you got? 65.
Yep.
And if you're done comparing sizes, I mean, it was funny.
Yeah, again, like, well-executed dick joke. That's not a thing you get to say very often.
Especially in a Marvel/Disney movie.
Yeah. And in all honesty, I think we both know who the happiest person on the planet was when Lawrence Fishburne was cast in this movie. Lawrence Fishburne!
Yeah. Because now he actually gets to be in a good comic book movie.
He's been saved from the DCEU. Like, I honestly almost want to find out that the scheduling conflict he had that kept him out of Justice League was this movie.
I would love that.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing.
It's probably not true, but it's kind of beautiful to think about.
Given how floundering everything is going on with DC right now, I wouldn't be surprised if we get more actors jumping ship. The only downside is we're not going to have all the Chrises in the MCU.
Eh, true.
Because Pine still has Wonder Woman in 1984.
Yeah, that's probably why he's in Wonder Woman 84. Just to keep him around. He is the Fantastic Four of casting choices. He's there just to keep him under contract.
Oh, jeez. So, I think, delving too much more into the plot, we're going to get into spoiler territory. I will say, before we get into that area, we have a character in this named Ghost, who in the comics was a white male, and in this movie is a Latina female. So this is another example of diversity casting that's done in a way where the original character is not being impacted, because that's one thing I'm always concerned about whenever these types of casting choices are made, is that so long as the character warrants it, That's great. We don't need to diversity cast just for the sake of it. We can do it, though, so long as the character remains intact. And that's certainly what's happened here. And I love the effects that they did for Ghost.
Yeah, wonderful visuals. And as a fan of the TV series Killjoys, anything that gets Hannah John Common onto the giant screen in any capacity, I will vehemently cheer for this.
Yes.
Because she is someone that is that rare action star casting that can do dramatic, and do dramatic very well.
Yeah.
And I cannot begin to describe how happy for her I am.
Yeah. And, again, still not quite entering spoiler territory, I will say that her character in this is not a villain. A lot of times in these Marvel movies, you just have a straight up villain, regardless of whether their motivations are well laid out or not. They're usually just a straight up villain. Even a character like Vulture in Spider-Man Homecoming was a straight up villain, even though you sympathize with where he is coming from. In this particular case, I don't see Ghost as a villain. I see her as an antagonist, but I don't see her as a straight up villain.
Vulture was a villain with a dash of victim.
Mm.
Ghost
is all victim.
Is victim with a dash of villain. because she's let's be honest, she's homicidal enough that you kind of still have to call her a villain.
I don't see it as homicidal. I see it as desperation.
That's actually exactly where I was about to go, because like, she's homicidal enough, you could call her a villain, but as they develop the character, as you see why she is so homicidal, you can, and again, kudos to Hannah John Common for this, you can't not sympathize with her, and she is also very, very much a victim.
Yeah. And, yeah, so with that, I mean, there's not really much more that we can get into with all of this, other than, of course, remarking about having Janet Van Dyne being played by Michelle Pfeiffer, Queen.
And if you've seen basically just about any 80s Michael Douglas movie ever, you were very happy with this.
Mm-hmm.
They picked up right where they left off back in the day.
Yeah. And she was fantastic in the role. I mean, she didn't have a hell of a lot of screen time, but what we saw of her was great.
Yeah.
And, of course, very, like, the prologue of the film, of course, we get a moment in the past, and we see them employing the de-aging technology once again. Actually,
it took Michelle Pfeiffer to get it right.
Michael Douglas was solid again for the de-aging.
Yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer was fucking brilliant for the de-aging.
No, that's when they finally got it.
But then here's the other thing, too. Then there was another scene a little bit later in the movie where we also see a flashback and we see the de-aging of Lawrence Fishburne.
That's true.
And that looked amazing. Yeah. Like, that's three star power older actors that they did de-aging with in this movie, and they all looked like they did back in the day, and it was amazing.
Yeah, like,
they've come leaps and bounds with this technology. So, yeah, I think we've beat around the bush long enough. Let's jump into spoilers.
Whoever had the idea to have Paul Rudd play the Wasp briefly, give that person a raise immediately. That was glorious.
Yes, so as it turns out, the reason that Scott Lang has that dream is that while he was briefly in the Quantum Realm in the first movie, Janet actually did some quantum whatever with him and basically turned him into an antenna. And when at one point in the movie, Hope and Hank try to start up the quantum tunnel, and it does open for like a split second, that sends a signal from the quantum realm into Scott, and hence the dream.
Yeah.
And so once they're able to properly open the quantum tunnel for a little bit longer, all of a sudden the and because Scott's right there, all of a sudden the antenna is just boom, and Janet is literally able to channel her consciousness through Scott, and we have this brilliant good 5 minutes of Paul Rudd basically playing Michelle Pfeiffer,
yep,
playing Janet, and it is amazing
and
brilliant physical comedy.
I'm gonna say not only brilliant physical comedy, I don't think we've seen an actor switch characters on screen that quickly.
And then switch back since
Orphan Black.
Yes.
Like, that was Tatiana Maslany levels of playing multiple characters.
Another actress that needs to get in the MCU.
Yes.
Oh my god.
I don't care. I almost don't care what the role is. Just give her something, please.
Yes.
A bit of an issue / kudos that I also had with Guardians 2, where, again, you do see a lot of the same gags from the first Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm.
But again, well executed,
yeah,
or tweaked just enough,
yeah,
that it doesn't feel the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have Luis being injected with the
truth serum. Oh my god. It is truth serum.
And it's just to do that bit from the first movie,
yeah,
of multiple, like, flashback within flashback. And having Michael Peña voice over other characters.
And having the actors basically acting in those little clips as though they were Michael Peña physically acting them out.
You'd almost swear that they did this just because Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly said, we want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if that's the case, I don't blame y'all.
Yeah, it was great.
Like, retread joke or not, they looked like they were having fun doing it.
Yeah.
And that alone can sell so much.
Exactly.
And again, speaking of Luis, the nice thing here is they actually give him more to do.
Yes.
He has his own storyline with the security firm.
Yeah. Basically being, quote unquote, the boss.
He has his own action sequence in the final act of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
They're like
product placement, but who cares?
Yeah. And there's almost this rule: if your movie is in San Francisco,
mm-hmm,
you're going to do a high-speed chase, flying over hills.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's just gonna happen.
Yep.
But and he's the one that gets to do that.
Yeah. But with the added twist of the fact that there's a moment where they're doing that jumping over the hill, and he's shrunken down. So, it's even more intense.
And of course, there's the main element of the plot, which is that, you know, like you said, they've figured out how to reach Janet.
Yes.
And they basically have their entire lab stolen at just about the last minute. So the whole...
Speaking of which, this is a building that, as I'm sure you saw in the trailer, literally shrinks down and grows back again. And they do this several times throughout the movie. Shrink it, grow it, shrink it, grow it. And it's almost a joke in and of itself to see where it pops up next.
Like, I think the nice thing there with the building is they almost accidentally address one of the objections that people had over the first trailer, which is, like, people thought this was a giant office building that had a whole shit ton of people in it. Giant office building, yes. Not so much with the people.
It was abandoned, basically. Yeah.
And once you realize that, it's like, oh, all right, I can go with this now.
Yeah.
Pretty much every problem I had with this movie are nitpicks.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't help but go, where is Hank Pym getting the money for this?
I have a suspicion that he had a lot in reserve over the years.
A lot, then. And
I mean, considering how long did he end up working for S.H.I.E.L.D.? probably decades.
True.
And considering what kind of an asset he was for S.H.I.E.L.D., I'm sure he was fairly well paid. And then he even still had his own company that he was still getting dividends from.
I can't call it perfect.
No, of course
not. But it's close. It is definitely a large step ahead from the previous movie.
I would say so, too. I mean, the biggest handicap that the original movie had was that it was largely Edgar Wright's vision, and he was no longer on the project. Yeah. So it was literally, you had, trying to remember who co-wrote with Paul Rudd and Peyton Reed on the script. It was the guy who did the Big Short.
I'll look it up and put it in a caption later.
And getting to Ghost, so the whole thing with her character is that she was, as a child, in a terrible accident. Her father was originally an employee of a colleague of Hank's. He had been accused of stealing some tech. He was removed. He went on to do his own experiments.
Basically, do you remember Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2? That.
Yeah. So he dies, his wife dies, his daughter survives, but is basically impacted by the event and is now in a state of her, at a molecular level, being broken down and rebuilt repeatedly. And because of that, she's slightly out of phase with our quantum time space
reality.
So, you know, she can literally phase through solid objects. And so Foster basically takes her in.
Foster basically fosters her. If you weren't taking that!
But, of course, at the time, he was working with S.H.I.E.L.D. So, she ends up being another one of these kind of cases of somebody who goes through tragic experience, ends up being taken in by government organization and being turned into a weapon for them. Foster takes her in again and works to try and help her and cure her. And their plan is basically to use Janet. She's been down in the quantum realm for so long, she's absorbed so much quantum energy. And they plan on extracting that from her and using that to effectively dephase her. But again, I don't consider her a villain. I consider her a victim of circumstance, and I consider her a person in a moment of desperation. I would say that overall, probably a 4 for me.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much in the same boat. A lot, again, my objections to it are
minuscule.
You get no credit for that.
It's the second time I've said that, okay?
Like I said, a lot of the just tiny things just built up and built up and built up.
No pun intended.
No, still not. And I'm only saying 4 as well, simply because we don't have a card for 4.5. Like, the reality is, this is not at the level of Infinity War or Black Panther, so I don't want to give it a 5. Mm-hmm. But I don't really want to knock off more than half a point, because as much as, again, it's not perfect, it's very much the movie we needed. And you can even hear Marvel Studios going, "Oh, you have complaints after Infinity War? It was a little too dark." Don't, we got you. Don't worry. They know what they're doing. Don't panic.
Have a towel.
Nice. And you know what? I said we're just gonna end it right there.
It's a wrap, folks.
Real Geeks is a Geeksploitation production. I like big butts and I cannot lie. They literally go from having Evangeline Lilly taking out a whole bunch of mobsters by herself to a one-on-one fight where she doesn't look like she has a ghost of a chance. I intended that one. Deal with it.